This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. It's been about 4 months since officials discovered an infestation of coconut rhinoceros beetles on Waialua Road behind Leeward Community College. It happens to sit on city land and was described as an illegal dump site where the beetles have been breeding. The city has asked Kamehameha Schools to use adjacent land for staging equipment needed to knock out the population of bugs. We talked with the city's Poyang Lai, the liaison with agricultural officials, about the progress being made to get the problem in check.
We treated that June 28th, and we treated that with the insecticide called Merit 0.5 G. And after the treatment, then our facility management people come in with a water tank. We spray with the water so that that will enhance the composting process, so the temperature will build up. And then the following week, the Tuesday, then the tiller came in to till the whole area down, and so that we can turn the material upside down, and that also enhancing the temperature build up. After that, the Department of Ag went back there, and they couldn't find any more larvae or adults. So that means the treatment is working now in controlling the beetle there. So the reason why we're approaching Kamehameha School is the next phase, what we try to do is use the Navy's the technology called in-vessel composting. So we're going to use we're going to have about an area is about 2 acres, and to put the a few 40-footer, the container, and then retrofit it so that we can put all the material from, let's say, Waialua Road, those wood chip, we can load it on the 40-footer container, and then we put in the urea and thermophilic bacteria, and then we can compost, cover it, and then that enhance for the composting of the material. So after that in-vessel composting done, we would ensure that there's no larvae or adults or even the eggs survive in the material.
And the whole idea behind the heat, what does the heat do?
That would make sure killing all the beetle in there, so the material we can... After that in-vessel composting, then we can move it to H power for incineration, or if we want to, for the composting, we can do that. Send it to the Hawaiian Earth product for the composting. We have found a little over about 1,300, mostly in the larval stage, and some adult, and the fewer pupae, and also we found some egg too, so... So different stages, but mainly it's a larval stage and then adult stage.
Okay, those are the two, but no more stages. Since the last time we talked then?
That's correct.
Okay.
After the treatment of the site, we haven't found any more the beetle from that site.
Okay, good. All right, well, that's a good thing.
Yes.
Okay, but you may need to bring some of that material... 2H power to be burned. You just want to make sure that you don't spread the problem around in the process.
That's correct. So the in-vessel composting to make sure everything is taken care of and then killed before we move the material to either H power or composting.
Okay.
At the Hawaiian Earth product.
So has the military come out to see the site?
We Department of Ag was in the process of discussing with Navy, okay, so because it's impossible, in terms of moving the material out of the area into the non-restricted area and then to Navy become a problem. So that's the reason why we need to have a staging area for close by, and that's where the Kamehameha School had land there behind LCC, so that we can use this space, about 2 acres or so, for putting all the 40-footed containers and everything in there, and even, you know, work in that area so that we can have enough space for doing the composting.
Did they agree to that, or you're still working out the memorandum of understanding?
We're still working on that.
Okay.
We're still working on that. Community school said they would look at, they know why we're requesting for. They will review it and then get back to us. The finding in the trap still relatively high in the per city area. Okay. Per city, Iloco Point, and Eva. These three areas are the major finding in the trap, inside the trap. And then, of course, the Waipio Peninsula also, we found that. Very recently, we found one male at the UH campus.
You're talking say West Oahu?
Oahu, yeah.
UH West Manoa. Oahu or Manoa?
Manoa. We haven't found anything there before that, but only recently we found one male there.
How recently?
Oh, that's, in fact, that's the week before, this week, and then last week. Last week we found one male in the campus. We found it in Kunia, Milani, and in that area. The key thing is they're not breeding there. They may be carried by the wind and spreading there. So far we haven't found any breeding site in that area.
The city's Environmental Services Director, Loi Kina, has said she's willing to burn the compost at H-Power, the city's garbage-to-energy plant, and suggested officials declare an emergency situation. Officials have also reached out to the military, which has been working to keep the pest in check on its property for the last 5 years. To report a sighting, call the hotline at 643-PEST.
Hawaii Public Radio is a source for fresh water. It's a source for information that I would drink and information that I would share, information that I would give to my child. And I think the more we understand that and acknowledge that, the more we realize that Hawaii Public Radio is a bastion for truth.
Member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Radio with vision. Listen and see.
Coming Saturday, August 24th to HPR's Atherton Studio. It's a big band with an even bigger sound that will make you want to dance. Agua Dulce Salsa Band brings their ensemble sound of salsa, featuring splashes of reggae, hip-hop, jazz, and funk. For tickets, visit hprtickets.org. Sponsored by Amoresco.
This is The Conversation on statewide, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. In today's backyard quiz, it's about a short story written by a celebrated writer then living in Hawaii when he published it back in 1891. In the story, a Hawaiian man from Honoka'a named Keawe gets his hands on a bottle that is said to have magical powers. It can bring extreme wealth, but as usually happens with such things, there is a catch. The owner has to sell the bottle for hard currency before he dies, and he has to sell it at a loss. Keawe buys the bottle, and all goes well for a while. He gets rich, gets himself a fancy house on Hawaii Island and a pile of money, and then he sells the bottle. That's not where the story ends, though. In today's backyard, we're looking for the name of that short story and, for extra credit, the name of its author. Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets a reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from First Insurance Company of Hawaii, providing auto insurance since 1911, committed to delivering personal attention and expert advice. First Insurance Company of Hawaii, FICOH.com.
It's called the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea, and it covers everything from freedom of navigation to fishing rights. Last week, we told you about an effort being led by Hawaii Senator Mazie Hirono to ratify an international maritime treaty that has been sitting in the U.S. Senate for 25 years. The U.S. signed the treaty in 1994, but the Senate never finalized the deal with a two-thirds majority vote as required by the U.S. Constitution. Robert Guerrier is a retired U.S. Navy admiral who now heads the Honolulu-based think tank Pacific Forum. He told HBR's Ryan Finnerty that failure to ratify the Law of the Sea Treaty makes it more difficult to address disputes like China's island building in the South China Sea.
I fully support the ratification of the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea. I think it's on balance overall in the U.S. interests. Over the years, the U.S. position has been that the vast majority of all the provisions, in fact, almost its entirety, is supported by customary international law. And the U.S. has a long history of supporting. It's been one of the biggest champions, quite frankly. And in the end, the fact that we have not ratified it tends to diminish the impact of all the support and weight and authority, if you will, that the treaty has represented over the years. Let me be more specific on that. The elements that I think have caused us not to ratify it were concerns initially about this element called the International Seabed Authority, and that at that time, this is back in the and again late 80s and 90s, were believed to disadvantage industrialized countries. It made it tougher for them to basically make a profit on deep seabed mining. And so that was considered by many to disadvantage, if you will, the industrialized nations. Those provisions were largely addressed, by the way, in 94. And so then, but still it hasn't been ratified. And then the other reasons, the other areas that have caused some parties to hold back and not get the consensus that we need in the U.S. was a concern about U.S. giving up some element of its sovereignty and being subject to international proceedings, and I think that's probably the current outlying issue right now, that there's concerns about if you join this treaty you might become subject to charges, claims by other nations that are party to it. That might not have merit or might not have full weight. And why do that if the vast majority of the provisions, the navigational provisions specifically, are already enshrined, if you will, in customary international law? My answer to that is that no treaty is perfect, but this has gone a long, long way in representing rule of law and international conduct among the global commons of our oceans, and also how to thread that needle between coastal states' rights and sovereignty issues and jurisdiction, and how you balance those with those other rights for access, for free communication, for transit in between the high seas, if you will, and areas beyond the territorial seas of any state. So the Law of the Sea Treaty covers all those elements. And it ends up being a real mouthful to say, well, we're not party to the treaty, but we do believe in all the navigational provisions as they reflect customary international law. But in the end, people hear, but you haven't ratified the treaty. And so I think as a matter of leadership, as a matter of supporting the great work that this represents, it's in our overall benefit. And it also shows leadership. I mean, this is an area where norms are being challenged. We're seeing this on the news every day in other areas, whether it be claims from China or Russia or others that are pushing back on heretofore widely accepted norms in the international order, if you will. This represents part of that.
You mentioned that this is a very complex space in the current world, and you've talked about the South China Sea. There are other international actors kind of muddying the waters, particularly in the Arctic, as sea ice starts to melt and those waters become more navigable. How does this treaty potentially offer a solution or a path to deal with some of these very complex geopolitical issues?
Well, I mean, it, from the beginning, it comes up with a basic standard of territorial seas, contiguous zones, and exclusive economic zones. And then layered on top of that are continental shelf issues, which get into resources. And I think those are some of the issues that you'll also see when it comes to the Arctic ice retreating and access. But on the very basic elements of freedom of navigation and the right to transit, no matter where you are, even in international straits that are less than 12 nautical miles across, it upholds those basic fundamental values, or I should say principles, and those are universal. I think that's very important. It's a universal standard that's truly international, that's truly global. What you're seeing being challenged, especially in the South China Sea, is a regional application and a country asserting a view with historic rights. Let's take the Nine Dash Line, for instance. And that is kind of overwriting these other areas. It says, well, you know, a country makes the assertion, China in this case, oh, I have a nine-dash line, and that's a historic claim of mine. And that's what should hold sway. And then this is our sea, regardless of whether or not that overlaps several exclusive economic zones and territorial seas and waters, not even mentioning disputed islands and features, you know, in the Spratlys. And this is a way of navigating through that, quite literally. And so the Philippines, in 2013, they applied for ruling via an arbitral tribunal, which is a mechanism that's part of the treaty. And it took 3 years and lots of very careful, you know, but again by a third party that said no in the end. The arbitral ruling came out in 2016 in July, and you know, found that there was no legal basis for the historic claims, that others had historic claims there as well. I mean, no one's saying that the Chinese hadn't fished there before, but so had the Vietnamese, so had the Philippine people, and so there's overlapping claims. So it didn't overwrite, if you will, the existing framework.
But China continues to expand the construction of artificial islands and to harass fishing vessels of different nations in that region and to kind of assert those territorial claims. So what is the role of an international treaty like the Convention on the Law of the Sea, or how does it fit in when you have a member state that's sort of not playing by the rules?
Well, I think a first step is, and again, this so I'll make the argument that therefore, when others dispute this, even those that are members to the treaty, you know, it helps when other significant players, you know, world leaders, the U.S. joins the treaty and says, no, this is a very fine set of guidelines, set of a framework that should be supported. So there's friction, there's pushback, but it doesn't mean you drop what you're doing and give up. I think it makes the case for now more than ever. Like-minded countries, which are very numerous, but I think in a world where you have disputes, where you have not everyone is on the same page, so to speak, when you have those that disagree, especially significant, powerful players, you know, the answer isn't conflict. The immediate answer is the rule of law. The answer is like-minded countries counter-asserting that no, this is the norm, and that we believe in this strongly. So I think, again, the U.S. joining the treaty gives weight to that argument.
And when you were on active duty in the U.S. Navy, was it your experience that support for the convention amongst senior military leaders?
The Department of Defense, the Navy, Coast Guard, they're on record as supporting this. There's a long record. And I don't speak for anyone official in the government now or for the Navy, but I can say if you simply look at the history and the record that's out there, you'll see that there's significant support by government entities through the years that has been very consistent. But this whole notion for those that make their business on the sea, and you see why, you see the logic of that, because on the other hand, you have the territorial, as I mentioned, the coastal nation rights and their interests and their equities. But on the same token, especially in a maritime nation like the U.S. or those that trade, you realize that the seas connect. They do so much more than just separate, and increasingly they connect more and more. And so the value of this ability to travel where and when you need to without asking permission, that's a very common theme. And the U.S. sees that. It's been part of our history. So it's very logical that those in the maritime services understand how important connectivity is, how important the need to communicate, to be able to transit freely, and not have to get a vote or a yes or a no or a permission slip, so to speak, from anyone else. And so there's a really clean logic in all of that, and that's why there's a longstanding support from the maritime services.
All right. Well, retired Admiral Robert Guerrier, thanks so much for your time today.
I appreciate it. Thanks very much.
Again, that was Robert Guerrier, retired U.S. Navy Rear Admiral and president of Pacific Forum, a Honolulu-based foreign policy think tank. You can find more coverage of this issue at HawaiiPublicRadio.org.
Coming Saturday, August 17th to HPR's Atherton Studio. It's an evening of slack key guitar, classic as well as not so traditional, when local virtuoso Stephen Inglis joins us for a solo performance. For tickets, visit hprtickets.org or call the station during business hours. Sponsored by Amoresco.
We've all been watching the progress of Honolulu's $8 billion train as the guideway makes its way toward the airport and into town. But it's the Heart Board that's at the helm. That's the subject of today's reality check. Honolulu Civil Beats reporter Marcel Henry on the line today. Good morning.
Aloha, Catherine. Happy Tuesday.
Yes. And so I understand from your story that while we have extra board members that were supposed to monitor the progress of rail, they're not showing up.
That's right. These are state-appointed board members. These are extra seats that were added in 2017. You might remember the state had to bail out the project yet again with what at that time was a $2.4 billion bailout package. And so part of that, to add extra scrutiny and to try and give the public some assurance, you know, that they were keeping a better eye on things, was to add these board seats. The problem is that so far this year, by and large, those board members, with one exception, really, they have not been showing up to these meetings. Two of the seats have been vacant going back to last year. State Senate leaders say that they're having trouble filling those two seats. And then another board member, the fourth member sitting in that seat, just resigned last week, right around the time that I was trying to catch up with what his status on the board was. And he had not been at a meeting since January. So all in all, you've basically had one person from the state in there and these three empty seats.
Well, kudos to the one person who has been attending those meetings. Who is it?
That's right. Shout out to Michelle Brungraber. She has, as I understand it, it's pretty interesting. She has a background working with the CIA and deals a lot with federal contracts in her work. And she's one of the more inquisitive board members. She asks a lot of great questions. She is, however, a non-voting member. It's a key thing to add. Overall, the Heart Board is a voluntary board. That's an important point to make. And these four extra seats were non-voting seats. They were really just a way to kind of keep eyes and ears in the board meetings. But the addition of those four seats has caused a lot of issues for Hart in terms of its quorum and its voting rules. Those non-voting seats, if you can kind of try and follow along, they add those to the overall total. So when they have to make a vote, when they take votes, they need 8 of 9 voting members to vote in the affirmative to pass anything, because they're still including those extra non-voting members as part of the total. So in a lot of ways, it's made life a little complicated for Hart, and that has come back to bite them a little bit in a few key instances. you know, and that you might say that's fine. That's the price you get for this extra scrutiny. The issue, however, is that you're not getting quite as much scrutiny with these long-term vacancies.
Yeah, but it just is a dilemma when you can't do the business of the board.
Yeah, it's caused some issues, like, you know, and just when you go to these meetings, you'll see they cram all these action items to the front of the agenda, and they really try and race through, and they don't always get through it where people have to leave. Again, it's a volunteer board. People have other responsibilities and the like, which kind of brings up the larger issues and dynamics, which is that this is a, you know, as you mentioned, an $8 billion construction project, $9 billion when you throw in the financing. Those are the latest estimates. This is a mega, massive, complex project, and it's just been an issue retaining board members, you know, getting the expertise that they need, where people are willing to volunteer and make such a heavy commitment at the same time.
Well, now, as far as the other seats, who were the other no-shows?
So you have Kamani Kualaau is the, I guess, the technical no-show, at least for this year. He offered a resignation letter to Scott Sike, who's the House Speaker, last week, basically saying, you know, he's got a lot of heavy commitments with his job and his other duties, and he just isn't able to make it anymore. The two seats that were vacated, this goes back to November and December of last year. You had the former state budget director, Wes Machida, who had to resign just amid family issues that he had to help take care of. And interestingly, the other one was the CFO, Calbert Young, who had to leave. He wanted to stay on the board. But interestingly, they added under his job duties negotiating all the HART land agreements that the university needs as the system comes online for parking and space around the university. So it was a conflict of interest, and he actually just had to leave under those circumstances. The issue is that, you know, the state and the state senate, they haven't been able to fill those two seats now going on almost – we're almost coming up on a year. So,
yeah, that's unfortunate because both Wes Machida and Calbert Young – were good eyes to have.
Absolutely. Those are really good financial eyes, as you say.
Okay. And so, so I understand they had a meeting that they had to cancel this month because they won't have quorum.
Canceled this week, no quorum. So it keeps, you know, these issues just keep kind of stumbling along. And again, why do we care? This is like the largest ever, most expensive, most complex project, right? So it's kind of an important oversight issue.
Okay, $9 billion over eight. I stand corrected. Thanks so much, Marcel.
Sure thing. Thanks, Catherine.
That was reporter Marcel Henry with today's Reality Check. To read his full story, visit civilbeat.org.
Aloha, I am JP Joffre from Argentina. You are listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
Following last week's Hanaho broadcast about the homeless crisis on the neighbor islands, we were looking for constructive, practical, and compassionate solutions. We heard you on our talkback line. We start off with Michael Anthony from Kalihi.
My concern is with the homeless situation. I truly believe that it can be taken care of within 6 months, and within a year, really show some results. But what is stopping it is our participation as an island, meaning a place for the homeless to gather all at one time to take care of their health needs and their food needs first, and then have them work out a system where they have work coming their way. be done in many different ways in cleaning up the island. We have the facilities, we have the people, and we have the heart to make it happen. I just heard your conversation and wanted to have input. Bye now.
Aloha. My name is Mike. Hi. I was trying to get your email address so I can tell you guys what a great plan is for people in our conditions, you know, who don't have the money and full-time job and family support to help us. But low-income parks, call it Compassion Park, you know, and have a place to have food right there, bathroom, shower, and wash machine. It's disrespectful to put troubles on other people. And when you're, whatever your condition is, if they're in the city, they're making it bad for other people by, you know, urinating here and there and causing trouble and trash. But you just got to get them out of there and give them a place. So, but there's no place. Everybody buys the land up there, all, you know, greedy, money, you know. But if they can just make some compassion parks, like maybe 8 places around the islands that people can go and have a host there, the keep them maintained. They only have like 10 items that they can have with them, and no trash for if they leave, but, you know, well-monitored. But anyhow, we have a solution for everything, and it's real cheap. Anyways, aloha. Thank you.
We also received a comment from a listener in reaction to our recent call-in program discussing solutions to Hawaii's Opala problems. He shared his take on trash pickup and recycling programs. Here's what he had to say.
Hi, this is Ryan Quinn from PA Maui. I heard on the program that they were thinking about expanding the curbside recycling program on Maui to be island-wide. That's a great idea. I've been surrounded by my whole neighborhood has got the program going, and then our little area in the middle does not. So I really like to have that in my block. All right. Thank you very much. Aloha.
This is Natalie McKinney from Pukua Hawaii Foundation. I'm calling from Oahu and just wanted to let the public know that the Integrated Solid Waste Management Plan is now out for public review. This is our 10-year plan for solid waste management for the island of Oahu. Public review comment period ends August 27th, 2019, and people can go to opala.org/solid-waste-notices to download the plan, review it, and make public comments. This is a 10-year plan that is renewed every decade, so this is a once-in-a-decade opportunity for the general public to participate and give public feedback into our waste management practices for the next 10 years. Mahalo.
That sounds like a story that we should do. Thanks for the feedback. Email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Reach out via social media on Facebook or Twitter, or call our talkback line at 792-8217. Today's Backyard Quiz asked you for the name of a short story set on Hawaii Island in the 1890s. It's about a bottle with magic powers, and it's called The Bottle Imp. The author was Robert Louis Stevenson. In it, a Hawaiian man named Keawe finds out that buying a bottle with an imp inside was the worst mistake he ever made. He gets rich at first, but then his fortunes change, and not for the better. He ends up selling the bottle and then desperately needing it back, but it must be sold for a loss each time. By the time he tracks it down on Honolulu's Barataria Street, its value is a single penny, so low that it can't be marked down anymore. Robert Louis Stevenson got the story of the bottle imp from an old German folktale and adapted it to Hawaii. And today's winner, you got it right, Melly Stokesbury from Pukulani, Maui. That's our backyard quiz for today. If you have one, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. In our Hawaii Garden and Forest segment, we turned our attention to a noted public garden and historic estate in Northern California with Hawaii ties. If the name Lurline is familiar, you may know it as the name of a street in the Manalani Heights neighborhood on Oahu in a nod to the Hawaii shipping industry. But it was also the name of the daughter of shipping magnate Captain William Matson, who secured Failoli Gardens for all to enjoy. We visited there recently and sat down with CEO Kara Newport to talk about the history of the formal Golden Age garden that Lurline Matson Roth helped develop on the 647-acre site. The Woodside, California property was home to two prominent families, William Bourne, who made his money during the gold rush, and William and Lurline Matson Roth of the Matson Shipping Company.
Failoli Estate in Woodside, California is a 100-year-old estate that was first built by the Bourne family, William Bowers Bourne, and he was the part of the gold mining to begin with, and then became part of Spring Valley Water. So he was associated with water and utilities and public utilities and things like that. So he built the house with his wife and in 1917. And then in 1937, the Roth family, who was part of the Matson family, purchased the home. And they purchased it from the Bournes, fully furnished. They actually already had a home in Woodside, the Waiwuri Farm. But they wanted a home for their family and for entertaining, and really they wanted a ballroom for their daughter's debut ball. They had twin daughters, Lurline and Brennis, were their twin daughters. So they had their debut ball in the ballroom here at Failoli. So the Matson line, I think everybody knows the story about the Matson line and how that made the connection really between San Francisco and Hawaii. But the Roth family had a home in Hawaii as well, and that connection was really strong. But they really established that connection between San Francisco and Hawaii and had a love for both places. And I think you saw that through their homes, both here and in Hawaii. So it was something that came through a lot. And in fact, we just had our first gala last year, and our theme for that gala, fundraising gala, was Pacific Paradise in honor of the Hawaiian connection. And we had a Hawaiian chef who helped with the food for that from Liholiho Yacht Club. So we're still celebrating the connection to the islands.
And so talk about the challenges of having a house museum, because this was really a home for two families, and it's now a public garden,
right?
But it's also a museum.
Yes. So in 1975, the Roth family generously gave the house and the gardens to the National Trust for Historic Preservation. And at that time, then, it was opened as a house museum. So really, what I love about this estate is that it has been in continuous operation for over 100 years now. And that isn't typical. Usually, a house museum falls into disrepair and goes through many hands, and then it becomes a house museum. And then people have to revive it. But because it was this continuum, because the Roths had the foresight to see that, you know, it needed to be held in public trust, we were able to, we being Failoli Center, the nonprofit, pick up and just begin operating that as a house museum and garden. We're probably better known as a public garden, which is a great that's really greatly attributed to Lurline Roth, who had an eye for gardening and really developed the gardens during her time. And that's really continued. So the garden continued to evolve and grow. And, you know, we have climate change, so we have to think about what we're planting. So, you know, that historic landscape evolves over time. And then the house has evolved as well. The house was given to the trust empty. And so over time, there were many, many different things considered, you know, should it be a bed and breakfast? Should it be many things? But it became a house museum. And so over that time, we've been recollecting items back into our collection to represent both eras. Because again, the Roth family purchased it furnished. So there was a great history of, we have photos from both families that the rooms are virtually identical. So the Roths kept a lot of the look and feel of the rooms and just added their own touches, especially from their world travels, and their personal fingerprint was on it. But from our perspective, it's really great because we can just take those pictures from the past and work through recreating the rooms.
And you have an exhibit currently, Nests, I think. Yes. As we were driving up, we saw the wonderful the forms out in the gardens up front.
Right, the floating nests, right? So so as Filoli has, you know, we're a nonprofit. We developed a strategic plan last year for the next 5 years and really realized that we need to be relevant for our current audience and we need to find ways to connect to a current audience. And one of those ways that we thought of is by telling more stories. You know, we tell great stories about the Boren family and the Roth family, but let's tell the stories about the other people who created home here at Filoli and the people who really built Filoli. So we've been digging through the archives and really pulling out the stories of the different people who worked at Filoli over the years and telling those stories in a different way. And then you mentioned the actual nests. We also have an exhibition of nests on the property that are artistic nests inspired by nature. And really we wanted to reflect the people, plants, and animals who have called Filoli home. So who created home here? And at any given time, we learned there could have been 4 or 5 or 6 languages spoken at Filoli. It was actually a very diverse group of people that lived and worked here together.
Yeah, as I was looking at the exhibits in the gallery downstairs, you had, I think, wonderful imagery on the wall. I think there were a couple of gals from Japan. There were some also from Europe. The immigrant stories.
Right, exactly. And that's really, you know, we also have an art exhibition in our visitor center that's about women and birds and migration and, you know, how we've all in some ways migrated from different places. I moved here from North Carolina. So, you know, even if it isn't from around the world, everyone kind of has a migration story, if not an immigration story. But we have some pretty compelling immigration stories in our history. People came from different parts of the world just for these jobs. We had a Japanese butler. We had a Chinese, several Chinese cooks and chefs. And it was really, you know, very diverse. We had Italian and Hungarian gardeners. So people from all over the world working together and, you know, again, speaking different languages and, you know, really working out how to work together through that, kind of like we are today.
Going forward, I mean, the exhibit right now, you've got the theme of the nest and the people who helped to create the nest and the feeling in this home museum and public gardens. And really, I think that's side of the story that if folks know the Mattson name, they may not be familiar with the things that Lurleen Mattson did in this area here in California. But right. The fact that you have a public garden, because the story that I read was they were going to sell the home and then the buyer did not want to make the area public, and that was very important to her.
They were thinking about what to do with this beautiful intact estate. And not only do we have the house and gardens and 125 acres that's owned by the National Trust, the Filoli Center owns an additional 500 acres. So we have a lot of land that's part of the original estate, and 16 acres of it is informal gardens, English style mostly gardens, and that was really, you know, it was originally the Boren vision structurally, but it was the Mrs. Roth who came in and added her wonderful touches. For example, we have an incredible camellia collection, and that's really, you know, attributable to her. She really loved camellias and brought them in. And so when she was thinking about how to turn this over, you know, to the next owner, the next generation, the people who wanted to buy it had different ideas about it. And she really couldn't imagine not inviting people to come in and see the garden, because she had been doing that for years. She invited people to come to tea in the afternoon. In fact, I believe the story is there was almost an open invitation to come for tea in the afternoon and see the gardens. And she had, you know, wonderful parties here. You know, it was really a place that was for other people. You know, she really wanted other people to enjoy it. And so by bringing in the National Trust, she was able to continue that vision.
And so the foundation here has also opened up the trails. I think there's a number of tours that you can take, you know, with, you know, just you've got the trails and the preserve, and you've got the gardens, and then you have the historic home. So a lot of different
themes going on.
And we're even adding more to that. But in the past few years, we've opened up what we call the Estate Trail. We have a nature center, and we consider that, you know, 500-ish acres a nature preserve. And the nature center previously was really used for just school groups, and we thought everybody would love this. So we've opened it up. We have private hikes where you can go into kind of the secret back areas of the estate. We have several miles of trails back there. We also do school programs, and I think that's important, both in the nature preserve, but also in the house and in the garden. So our school programs are able to access all of these different places as well as part of being open and available for the public. And we're finding more and more ways to do that too. And we have a wonderful orchard, and we're doing more events in our orchard, and we're also finding ways to produce more out of our orchard. The orchard was originally there as a cider orchard for the family, and so this year we are for the first time producing hard cider that we'll have available. We've always produced apple butters and jams and had that available from the orchard. So, you know, having people access that more and learn about, you know, both the history of it, but how it's still relevant in production today.
And so you talk about a strategic plan that you folks are working on. So then what's ahead?
So yeah, that's a great question. So what's ahead is kind of just more. You know, we feel like we're on a great path, and you know, everything, our bones are really good. You know, we have really good structural things, but how can we invite more people in? How can we make Failuli more accessible? How can we invite in diverse audiences? One thing that we did last year is we opened the holiday program up. We had a very limited holiday program for 1 week. It was fantastic. But it was always sold out, and so nobody else could come, and then we were closed for 4 months. If you're not from here, San Francisco in the winter is pretty fantastic. If you're from here, you might think it's rainy and cold. But if you're from Minnesota, or like I am from Ohio, it's pretty amazing. So it's green and beautiful and pretty warm. And so we opened up those 4 months and went from a visitation of 10,000 to 40,000 in that same time period. And then we created a new holiday program that has evenings and allows people access to the garden. So it was really more in line with our mission, and not to mention we've used that opportunity to really flex our decorating muscles and are able to bring holiday decor into the house. So just another layer of beauty that we have.
Let's say if folks then want from Hawaii want to come visit, that might be a good time for them.
Absolutely. But I would say Failuli's amazing year-round, and that's the great thing. We're open year-round now. People can, you know, come anytime. We have extended hours in the summer nights. But the other thing I want to mention in our strategic plan is that, you know, one of the challenges you asked me in the beginning of being a historic house and being open is that we age, you know, we're 100 years old. And so even different than 1975, you know, we have quite a few years on us, and things break, and they, you know, they age. And so preservation is really costly. So we have to find ways to continue to invest in preservation and develop resources to invest in it and develop enthusiasm around investing in it. So just this week, we actually renovated one of our rooms, the drawing room, and brought it back to more historically relevant. And that was contributed to by over 60 donors who helped make that one room possible, including a donor who brought back a collection of 30 mezzo tents or prints for the walls. So there are things happening all the time now and year round, and it's not just the garden, and it's not just events, it's in the house. And that's part of our strategic plan, is just to keep things fresh and active and alive and interesting. You know, we want people to come back again and again.
That was Failuli CEO Karen Newport. The Nest exhibit at Failuli runs through November. And if you were wondering about the name Failuli, well, its roots are with the slogan, fight for a just cause, love your fellow man, and live a good life. We'll be exploring more of the Hawaii stories with curator Julie Bly-DeVere, and we plan to talk with one of the many Lurleens of the Mattson family. Thank you. that wraps it up for now. Up tomorrow, we look at the massive effort to remove large schools of tilapia on Kauai's North Shore. The state plans to meet with local fishermen to help in the effort of netting the invasive fish. Tell us what's on your mind. Call our talkback line. Leave us a comment. The number to do that, 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. We're on Facebook at The Conversation HPR and on Twitter at HI Conversation. And if you missed any of this show or want to find a past one, find them on The Conversation page. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow, won't you, for more of The Conversation.